Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Vladimir Putin is Russia's strongman. He talks tough with his enemies. He has a mythic public persona. He's loved and feared and reaching again for the Russian presidency. But as votes from last Sunday's parliamentary election were counted this week in Russia, Putin's party took a major hit, even after stuffing the ballot boxes, according to international observers. Now, big protests in Moscow and beyond, the biggest since the fall of communism, and more coming, we're told. This hour on Point, what is happening in Putin's Russia? Elections on Sunday, all kinds of reports of irregularities there, of a rigged vote. Russians took to the streets on Monday to protest. At first, police allowed the larger-than-expected demonstrations, but then began a crackdown that ended with hundreds of arrests. Here's the sound of the crowd as Russian riot police began making arrests. Not too happy. Here the next day in Moscow's Red Square, where protests went on, a man who says he once backed Putin, a Russian here, but told the BBC he does not support Vladimir Putin anymore.
Now we look back and realize that we've got nothing. No reform of the police, no reform of the army, no battle against corruption. It's obvious that people who 2 years ago were fervent supporters of Putin, now they just say, look, mate, we hired you, but you haven't done anything.
Russia has not seen anything like this in years. We're going to take a close look today. Joining me first from Moscow is Julia Yaffe. She's a correspondent for both The New Yorker and Foreign Policy. She's been out reporting on the big demonstrations. Julia Yaffe, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So give us a sense of the arc of protests over this week. When did they begin? How did they unfold? Where do they stand now?
Well, the protest started on Monday night at Chistaya Prudnitsa, Wooded Boulevard in the center of Moscow. I went at the last minute thinking that it would be the same as most opposition protests usually are. You know, about 200-300 people, most of them elderly, yep. Dissidents from the Soviet era. And my jaw went slack. It was thousands and thousands of young people, mostly men, the educated middle class, people who have not really been engaged in politics outside of the, you know, kitchen table or the bar. They were all there peacefully. They were organized. They were shouting things like, Putin, go away. Russia without United Russia. Russia without Putin. It was really amazing. And then they came when they started to march towards Lubyanka, which is the headquarters of the FSB, where the KGB used to be, the police cracked down because they weren't allowed to march. The meeting was, the protest was allowed, but movement wasn't. And what shocked me the most then was that people weren't afraid. They didn't move. They didn't budge. They started screaming, this is our city. Shame on you. People started kind of trying to cajole the riot police, saying, you know, aren't you ashamed? You're one of us. Aren't you ashamed when you go home and take off that uniform? People just weren't scared. Before, people would run, and this time they didn't go away for hours.
We'll look at the protests and how they continue to unfold. There's more planned for Saturday, we read.
Yep.
A lot of social networking going on there. Take us back to that Sunday vote and the kind of thing that you and many others saw that raised all kinds of flags about vote rigging. What kind of rigging? What kind of problems, Julia?
One of my colleagues saw a very lovely Russian phenomenon known as a carousel, which is when a voter is given, or a bunch of voters are loaded up onto a bus, given a bunch of ballots, and taken around to different polling stations around, you know, whatever city or town they're in. And at each place they go, they have to put that stack in. The goal is to put it in not as a stack, but as individual ballots. So they vote early and often, as the saying goes. What I saw was I saw the vote counting process in a suburb of Moscow called Yasinova. When each of the three ballot boxes was cracked open, at first it looked like a big pile of ballots, but then when the local electoral commission started counting them and moving them around, you would see in each of these piles a little stack. It was perfectly folded, everything's perfectly stacked together, and when you open them up, they're all for United Russia.
United Russia, again, Putin's party, kind of preloaded ballot boxes there with neatly stacked piles you and others saw. What was the outcome? Even with this apparent rigging, there were big losses for United Russia, for Vladimir Putin's party. What did they end up with?
They ended up with 49.5%, and it's worth recalling that in 2007 the result was just over 63%, so it's almost a 15% loss. In 4 years, and that is keeping in mind that the state has almost total control over television, which is where the majority of Russians still get their information. They have control over the governors in each of the regions. All of these ballot stuffing maneuvers. There was the head of the Federal Central Election Commission is very openly partisan, very openly in support of Putin and United Russia. And even with all of this, they didn't even manage to scrape together 50%, or as some people say, didn't manage to give themselves 50%. I think they realized that if they, drew in those numbers, as Russians say, that there would be protests, but there were still protests. I think it was the nudge that people needed to. They saw that they went to the vote. A lot of people I know here went to vote, even though they'd never voted before, never saw any point in it, and they participated. And the people who came out on Monday night were the people who participated in the elections. It wasn't an abstract thing for them. They went and they voted, and they saw that because they did so, United Russia couldn't even manage 50%, and it seemed to be like the one push they needed to see that they could change something, that they could take control over their electoral and political system.
You wrote, Julia, that in the midst of the voting on Sunday, the Kremlin appeared to panic, sort of sent out the word for cracking down, harassing monitors, a full-on panic right in the middle of the vote.
It wasn't in the middle of the vote. In the middle of the vote, there was a denial of service attacks on many liberal media outlets. But in the week leading up to the vote, there seemed to be panic. They harassed the one independent election monitor that's domestic, Golos or Voice or Vote, was harassed. Their director was held up at the airport. Her laptop was seized. They aired a hatchet job on them on national TV. They went after them pretty hard.
What was it before this vote that you think revved Russians up to come out and vote? You say usually you'd have 200 or 300 protesting, you'd have a much smaller turnout. What were the signs in the air with pretty complete government media control that got people to the vote and fired up in the first place?
I just keep remembering that this summer, a lot of my colleagues and I, both Russian and foreign journalists, would sit around and talk about how boring the political system was, how there was nothing to write about, how depressing it was. And then came September 24th, when United Russia got together in a big stadium and held their Congress that was that looked a lot like the DNC or the RNC. And nobody was expecting it, but Putin got up there. President Medvedev got up there, it was amazing. A sitting president said, "I don't want to run for a second term. I would rather that my prime minister run instead of me for president, and I'll just become prime minister."
So Putin's had two terms already. He's set out while Medvedev has been there, and now...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it was just so cynically, brazenly done. It was. It recalled a joke from back in 2008 from when... Vladimir Putin decided to step down from the presidency and respect the letter of the law of the Russian Constitution, no more than two consecutive terms, and handpicked a successor, Dmitry Medvedev, who became president, and Putin became prime minister. The joke was that, in 2023 or, in some distant future, the two of them are sitting around and drinking, and, Putin says, I've lost track. Which one of us is president? Which one is prime minister? Medvedev says, you know, I think you're president now, and I'm prime minister.
But,
and Putin says, all right, your turn. Go get some beer.
Off we go. But the image abroad, and we thought the image in Russia, Julia, was of Putin as this kind of, you know, beloved strong man. I mean, there's all these images coming out of him bare-chested in Siberia, shooting tigers and harpooning whales and riding motorcycles and pulling ancient urns up from the bottom of the sea in scuba gear. Is he not that kind of mythic leader figure now?
You know, I think he was until September 24th. I think the cynicism and the brazenness with which he just announced this swap without really consulting anyone, it was very clear that it was a one-man decision, really angered a lot of people. And there was a sudden sense that, you know, people just had reached their breaking point. They were really fed up with it. There's still a lot of people that like Putin. He still has very good approval numbers. It's, you know, higher than any politician here. He has, you know, nobody even comes close to him in terms of approval ratings, but that's because he has scorched and burned the political field around him.
In spite of all this, is there any doubt that he will be president again?
You know, if you had asked me a week ago, I would have said no doubt at all. I think he'll still be president. I think he'll just have a much tougher time getting there and have a much harder time ruling because the thinking, active, you know, yes, they're the minority, but the thinking, acting, moving, shaking urban elite has just risen up against him.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russians up in arms over an apparently rigged election, taking to the streets over what protesters are calling Vladimir Putin's party of crooks and thieves. It's the phrase of a big-time opposition blogger there, Alexei Navalny. It's the sound of him being arrested on Monday night, right there behind us. And, of course, lots of attention to this from around the world, not least from Washington, or at least State Department Chief Hillary Clinton. Here she was speaking in Bonn, Germany, on Tuesday, saying the Russian people deserve full investigations into reports of electoral fraud, citing here a report from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, which has called the elections unfair.
We do have serious concerns about the conduct of the elections. We think that the preliminary report just issued by the OSCE International Mission raised a number of questions about the conduct of the elections. The OSCE, for example, cites election day attempts to stuff ballot boxes, manipulate voter lists, and other troubling practices.
We've been joined from Moscow by Julia Yaffe. She reports from there for the New Yorker magazine, for Foreign Policy magazine. With us as well right now from New York is Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian and Slavic studies and history at New York University. He's often in Russia, was last there just a couple of 3 weeks ago, author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, Failed Crusade. Stephen Cohen, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
What do you see going on? We're all on the outside looking in. What do you see happening here?
Well, I hope you won't mind if I change the narrative.
Let's hear it.
There's a paradox in the American and to a certain extent the Russian media reporting. How is it possible that this was a blatantly rigged election vote, as is being said, and yet the Kremlin, which presumably did the rigging, its party lost 15% of its vote and its constitutional majority in the parliament.
Mm-hmm.
The two pieces don't fit. And I think the street protests are dictating, as important as those protests are, but let's put them aside for the moment,
okay,
because I really don't think they're the main story.
Mm-hmm.
But the street protests are dictating what we're saying and thinking. I would offer you a different perspective. These elections were the least rigged elections in nearly a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they're a very important step forward for Russia and Russian democracy. Are they a big step or a small step? We'll know soon, but I can't say today. In what sense are they a big step forward? Well, first of all, the result, the reported result, and I don't think it's accurate, but I think it's inaccurate in a way we haven't discussed that
okay
yet, but leave
all
that
right
aside.
Yep.
The the result more accurately reflects actual voter opinion in Russia than have any elections in a decade. Just to give you an example, there's a very eminent American academic whose name is Gordon Hahn, who specializes in studying polls and exit polls. He reported yesterday that he compared all the polling about 3 or 4 months prior to the voting, plus the exit polls done on Sunday, the day of the voting.
Yes.
And he found that the official results corresponded almost exactly to the pre-election surveys and the exit polls. That is, he doesn't see any significant fraudulence in the reports, in the reported returns. So we begin with that.
That's important. That's easy to say from afar, looking on analytically. But what about the many, at this point, first-hand reports, including those from Julia Yaffe, who's with us right from Moscow, of the ballot boxes stuffed and the carousel voting?
It's a little naive to imagine that when the Kremlin fixes votes, as it's been doing for more than a decade, it does it by stuffing ballot boxes. We're talking about tens and tens of millions of voters. I grew up in the South, where ballot boxes were routinely stuffed. The joke was, did you vote today? Did I vote? I voted five times. The rigging is done when the returns come in to the regional counters and the Moscow counters, because the counters are controlled by the Kremlin. Whether they come in by electronically on computers or however they're doing it, that's when the Kremlin begins to move the actual vote around to various political parties the way it wants the outcome.
Well, let's say you're right about that, but that does not negate the sort of visual evidence of stacked ballots already in the boxes.
Well, this happened. This happened, but it's anecdotal evidence. Let me put it differently.
Mm-hmm.
For all that we know happened that was wrong, neither the street nor protesters nor the American media know the extent to which the results were falsified. Professor Gordon Kahn, an American who's hardly pro-Kremlin, reports that, in fact, they corresponded to what we in the West normally use to measure fair voting, that is, polls and exit polls. But let's say, I mean, I concede to you that these were not pure elections. What I'm trying to say is they were the best elections in a decade, and tell you why I think that's important.
Who won as Putin's party, the United Russia, lost? Who gained ground?
Well, I think that's the subject that's not discussed at all. Obviously, it was the Communist Party. Now, we Americans find that implausible, but the reality is that the only organized opposition political party in Russia, and this has been the case since the end of the Soviet Union, is the Russian Communist Party. The party doubled its vote on Sunday. It went from about 11 to about 20% of the popular vote, which will more or less double the number of deputies it has in the parliament. Now, what's interesting, if we take this back to rigging, are reports from Russia that the falsification primarily had to do with reducing the number of votes that the communists actually received.
But is it not possible? I mean, Julia's report suggests the Kremlin kind of panicking as they saw these results came in. They ended up with 49%, just almost 50 hanging on to sway in parliament. I mean, maybe it would have been a much worse loss.
It may have been, and we don't know. And as somebody who studied Russia for 40 years, I feel angry that the Russian government won't let me know what Russians really think politically. But the evidence we have, not the slogans in the streets, not the anecdotal evidence about on video or of ballot stuffing, the hard evidence we have is that the results are not far from the actual voting. And we ought to ask if that's important for Russia. And I'd say it is for a couple more reasons. One, that the new alignment of parties in the parliament, which has been a rubber stamp parliament, is called the Duma, means that the Kremlin, through its United Russia puppet party, can no longer simply ram through vital legislation, particularly social legislation, because the real cutting edge, if we ask what revved up the vote against the Kremlin, it was not democracy, it was economic and social issues, something analogous to what's happening in the United States. Secondly, for the first time in post-Soviet Russia, the ruling party lost its majority. Now, no Kremlin president has ever lost yet, but it's very important that the Kremlin be seen to have lost in the votes. And why is that important? Because people now, and I'm talking about both my younger and older friends in Russia, as Julia said, people who have never voted before, but people who have been voting with disgust for decades, now see that at least on more than just the margins, their votes can matter. They deprive this corrupt party of its enormous majority. And I think that all of these things are very, very important for Russia, and that that, not the street protest, is the main story coming out of these elections last Sunday. Now, the street protests are important, but you need to have balance and proportion and context, especially when you talk about Russia, which, you know, is not well reported in this country.
We're looking to do that right here. Stephen Cohen, stand by for a moment. I want to go to Julia Yaffe and then another view, Russian view out of Moscow. But Julia, first, what about Stephen Cohen's view of this outcome, notwithstanding the protest in the streets, this outcome is kind of a glass half full? What do you think of that, Julia?
Well, I think he's onto something there. I think that the fact that it didn't reach 50%, the fact that the election did actually more accurately reflect than any election in the Putin era what Russians have been feeling. And also, I want to backtrack for a second and comment on the vote rigging and the vote counting. I think that is just, at this point, just an extremity. The point is that even if the votes weren't, even if the ballot boxes weren't stuffed, and they were stuffed on a local level because the order came down through the vertical saying we need such and such results.
Yep.
And people at the bottom don't know any better and stuff ballot boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes all the way up the chain. There's, you know, the control of government resources, of government media, and there's all of that that happens years before this election.
So what?
But what I wanted to say is that, yes, this is an election that more accurately reflects than any election in the Putin era what people are feeling now. And I think because of that, because they got this mirror, I think people came out into the streets because it was a positive push. It was like, we can do something, we can change something. And I think that it's not totally political in the sense that people want, you know, freedom of this, freedom of that. And it's not totally social or economic either. I think it's just a general fed upness that is, I think, very hard to measure academically. But there is a sense among the educated elite, at least in Moscow and St. Petersburg, that they've had enough. That even if these falsifications and ballot box stuffing tricks didn't affect an election in which tens of millions of people voted, and that's true, the sense that this was still happening, that people were still being treated like fools and that their votes were manipulated in some way, there's just a sense that, like, it's an accumulation. It's the kind of the last drop.
A push there, a trigger. Julia Yaffe, stand by, please, in Moscow. And Stephen Cohen in New York. I want to bring in a Russian voice from Moscow. Tanya Lokshina joins us now. She's senior researcher at the Moscow Office of Human Rights Watch. Tanya, are you there?
Hi, Tom. I'm definitely there. And I've been listening with great attention for the past 15 minutes. So definitely easier to talk about numbers. I can easily say that over the past year, Putin, for example, lost about 11% of his rating, according to the polls. So his popularity went down from 78% to 67%.
Yep.
And if you look at the polls for 2007, back in November 2007, the United Russia, the ruling party, had the rating of about 68%. And by November 2011, it dropped to 52%. But I don't think that numbers are that crucially important.
Are the protests important, Tanya? Are the protests in the streets important?
The protests in the streets are really important. The reason the world is watching them right now with such intensity is that for the first time in years, Russians seem to be waking up. And the reason they're waking up, honestly, is because Macha president, or well, prime minister, or new Macha president or prime minister, apathetic population, a new apathetic population, people want to be treated like human beings with decision-making power. And one back in September, Medvedev made a statement saying that all decisions had been made years ago. That antagonized the public, the intellectuals in particular, quite a lot, simply because they felt like they were being, well, treated like cattle, not like human beings. And that's what triggered the protest.
Tanya, do you think that Vladimir Putin will be president again? Will Putin take the presidency again in spite of all this?
Well, what we are seeing in Russia today is no revolution. This is no Tahrir, at least not yet. So it is indeed likely that Putin is going to be president, but then at the same time, as we speak, the Kremlin is making yet another fatal mistake. And that mistake has to do with its media policy. Because when the entire world was watching those protests, there's thousands of people protesting the elections in the center of Moscow, all you could see on federal television were programs about wildlife, bird watching, and hunting. And now there is this huge indignation among all the thinking people, all those who actually use internet to go online looking for information, or journalists, in fact, journalists working for independent or at least quasi-independent media outlets who are looking at their colleagues working on television and who go like, what are you doing? This is not ethical. This is not professional. This is a lie.
But there were
and
the
hundreds
of...
That by making this happen, the Kremlin is actually exacerbating its own situation and making the protesters even more active than they were.
Hundreds of arrests in the world watching, however it's presented on Russian media. Tanya Lokshina, senior researcher at the Moscow Office of Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much for being with us for a few minutes right there, Tanya. We really appreciate it. Let's get a call in here. Alexei calling from Boston. Alexei, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say that people that are coming into the streets are pretty much fed with all what's going on. And those are the people that are not watching for the government channels. Those are the ones that are more of like younger generation that are getting their news somewhere else other than the public channels that are controlled by the government.
Like social media? Are you talking Facebook, Twitter, and all that realm, Alexei?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. And what I can say right now, what's happening is there are several groups in the Facebook. There is a Russian version of Facebook, and on those groups, people are going, people are gathering to the permitted meeting on Saturday, December 10th, to pretty much to say to the government that we are fed, we have been fooled. Because our votes have been pretty much just stolen from the poll offices.
Alexei, it's a familiar story from Egypt, from the U.S. in some ways. What do you think, watching from abroad? Do you think Vladimir Putin will become president anyway?
Well, I hope not. But what's in the past 12 years, there were 22 parties that were trying to be registered to have a chance to. Take a part in this Sunday's elections. So pretty much what happened since Vladimir Putin came to the power, he eliminated any chance of any other person to appear on the political arena.
Hear just a little bit of what Russians have heard in recent months. Over the summer, Putin's United Russia Party released a big television ad featuring a montage of clips from old Putin speeches. I'll give you just a flavor of it. He talks here, it's in Russian, I'll give you some sense, about improving pensions, improving health care, modernizing the country's different regions. It ends with Putin saying, "We are building a new Russia."
Мы, конечно, не можем и не будем бросать людей один на один с проблемами. Обещай им процветание завтра.
That's the voice of Vladimir Putin there, and all kinds of images rolling across the screen with the big timpani drum behind, you know, looking at the present, you know, fog and smog and traffic jams and dirty industry. Then it turns to the future. He talks about wanting to raise pensions and allowances for the military and reduce disease and mortality and healthcare modernization. Ends with a landscape of pictures, beautiful countryside, and the prime minister's words there again. We are building a new Russia. Stephen Cohen, let's step back for a second. The Soviet Union ended, here comes Russia into this period of oligarchy, democracy, call it what you will. What is this period of going on two decades now been like for this country? How's it brought us to whatever point we're at now?
Are you speaking about what it's been like for the Russian people?
Yes, for the whole spectrum. I mean, what's the change that happened?
Well, the Soviet Union ended 20 years ago in December 1991. And the first decade, the decade of the 1990s, when Boris Yeltsin was president of Russia, was for the overwhelming majority of Russian people simply hellish. They lost everything, including the middle class. That, in some ways, was the worst thing that happened in the 1990s, that the Soviet middle class, which was highly educated, highly professional, and had considerable savings in the bank, and which it could have been part of a new entrepreneurial Russia, the middle class was wiped out. 75% of the people fell into poverty. Pensions not only were worthless because of hyperinflation, but they simply weren't paid. Wages were often paid in kind. Therefore, the bit from Putin that you just quoted in his campaign ad resonates for Russia. Note that he begins by talking about pensions. A lot of people in Russia are on pensions. It's the equivalent of our Social Security and Medicare, and imagine how much that agitates us. But not only that middle-aged people care about what happens to their parents who are on pension, and young kids care about what happened to their grandparents. And what happened in the 1990s is they were left to die. Male life expectancy fell from about 66 years to under 58 years in the 1990s. So Putin is directing his appeal, as he has since he came to power in the year 2000 as president, to the great majority of Russians who suffered so terribly in the 1990s. And when Tanya, says, I think I heard her correctly in saying, that his personal popularity rating has fallen to only 65%.
Yeah, 67,
I mean,
yeah.
Barack Obama would be quite pleased with that figure. I mean, what one needs to explain, if we're trying to analyze where Russia has been and where it's going, is why Putin, even if he's only 50% as bad as we say he is in America, nonetheless, after 10 years, still has a 60% popularity rating. Now, there are explanations that are not flattering to him, but this is an important fact, and that is why, though there is some discussion as to whether or not Putin can win the presidency in March on the first ballot, because the Russian law says that you have to win 50% plus one vote.
Right.
Or you have to go into a runoff. And I think that's an interesting discussion. I wonder in my own mind that if it's a fair election, and by the way, fair doesn't mean just counting the votes. It means letting the opposition on television. That's why our political candidates raise a lot of money, so they can get on television. Like Russian voters and American voters, it's television. That's the medium. But Putin has so much going for him at the moment, that I personally think he will, in fact, win on the first ballot rather handedly. And let me just make one last point to go back to something I mentioned earlier. It's not the liberals in the street, though they're by far not all liberals. There are a lot of very ugly-looking nationalists in the streets, as Julia will tell you, in Moscow. People would not make us happy, wouldn't make Ms. Clinton happy. But the main opposition electoral force in the country is the Communist Party, like it or not. Personally, I think they got cheated. I think they got closer to 30% of the vote. But leave that aside. Its longtime leader, Gennady Zyuganov, will be Putin's primary rival. He ran against Yeltsin in 1996. That is, people in the West say, well, maybe Russians are tired of Putin's face. But Zyuganov has been the leading opposition candidate in presidential elections from before Putin even entered politics. So Putin has an awful lot in addition to the unfair practices going for him.
Stephen, stand by.
I don't think we need to. I don't think your other guests disagree that he is going to be president.
Julia Yaffe, let me ask you two things here. First, Vladimir Putin was welcomed by many people when he first took office. Stephen Cohen describes the 90s as hellish for many Russians. His approval rate is still 67%. What happened in this last decade that has brought the level of discontent that we now see in this election? And does it matter? Is there a chance he might not win? Does it matter if he does not win?
Well, look, for the first 8 years of his presidency, he had a lot going for him, and one of those things was oil prices going through the roof.
Yeah.
And, you know, as much as the friends that he brought in from St. Petersburg, as much as they took from the pie for themselves, there was a lot trickling down. And when he talked about stability and stability before reforms or before democracy, that Russians had to grow into it, that they had to have bread on the table before they could think about, you know, press freedoms or freedom to congregate. He had a point. The thing is that his own prophecy is kind of coming home to roost. The golden rain shower is ending. The Russian budget needs now a barrel of oil to cost $120 for them to balance the budget. At the start of his term, his first term, it was $20 a barrel. So they're kind of overstretched, and at the same time, the goodies are running out.
Do you see the opposition parties as changing things from their new strength? It's still in minority, but new strength in parliament.
I also think the communists are, talking about the communists as rivals is also not accurate. They are a strong force. At the same time, they've been totally co-opted by the Kremlin, as have all the two other parties in the Duma. They're either Kremlin creations to play the parties off each other, or they're directly in the Kremlin's pay and under the Kremlin's control. That's why the Kremlin itself talks about them as loyal opposition, as systemic opposition. So the fact that they drew votes away from United Russia in the end does not mean all that much, because they are, like United Russia, beholden and responsible to the Kremlin, not to their voters.
So what is this system, Julia? Is this oligarchy? Or it's hard to understand even, you know, what it is that Russia's become exactly.
I think it was an oligarchy. I mean, it has been an oligarchy for a while, but I just wanted to get back to the question of whether or not Putin becomes president. I think there's no doubt that he's going to become president. He has such high approval ratings, and his assistant in this, Vladislav Surkov, who is kind of the Russian Karl Rove, have cleared the field so thoroughly and have done such a good job on, and Putin himself has done a good job. He's a charismatic guy, and he plays all the things Russians want to see in a man and in a leader. He will handily win. The question is, what happens next? And will he, like today he made a statement about the constitutional right to demonstrate and about needing to talk to people who disagree and about needing to cooperate with them. And that's great, but at the same time, he said the people on the street are getting signals from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
At the same time, he's very dismissive of them, and this is in the last couple of weeks, we've heard this kind of neo-Cold War rhetoric coming from him constantly about things being done with foreign money, about who's the opposition loyal to, who are election monitors loyal to, And that's wonderful, and it's a very short term. It's a great short term strategy for deflecting blame and preserving your own skin. But in the long run, things have to change. Stability has worked for 10, 11 years, but it's done its work. I think people are not necessarily worrying about their bread or their gasoline or their pensions anymore. At a certain level of society, Something else has to happen now. And that whenever Putin has been asked about it in the last few months, since he said he's coming back as president, you know, what's the program? What are you going to change? He's been extremely vague. The only thing he has been able to talk in detail about is shale gas.
And the hope of that coming on, as it has come on in the U.S. I want to look at that, what might change, and also the U.S.-Russia angle. But if I may, let's bring in a few callers here. They're waiting patiently. Armin in Belmont, Massachusetts. Armin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What a great program and a fabulous discussion. I immigrated with my family from Moscow in 89 when Gorbachev was still in power. And I just wanted to kind of relay my emotions that my family, my colleagues and friends and back home are feeling, and how ecstatic we are to see what is happening both on the streets and on the forums, as the previous caller has said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of one angle I wanted to explain is how some of the diaspora here in the States feel about Russia, certainly my friends and my family. You know, when we came here in the 89 and early 90s before Yeltsin came in, there's certainly an apprehension from Americans of, you know, me as an immigrant from the big, scary red Russia. But at least there was apprehension, but it was almost a respectful fear. As the 90s progressed, and certainly as we have arrived to the current state of affairs where Putin and his cronies of maybe 140, 50 people now completely control the wealth of the country, it puts our 1% to shame. I'm embarrassed, and my family's embarrassed a lot of times to be associated with Russia as a homeland. And if anything, we're looking forward to the events, and we're very confident in the Russian spirit of revolutionary spirit.
To move toward what, Armin? To move toward what? To move toward a democracy? To move toward a reestablishment of the Soviet Union you felt pride in? Toward what?
Well, that's a good question, Tom. And you know, it's hard to answer that because you know, of what the previous guest had mentioned was that the nationalism on the streets is very scary. And as you can imagine, as a Jewish refugee in the in the late 80s, this is certainly something that we don't look forward to. But as the other guest mentioned, the pension situation in Russia is so dire. The predominant population of Russia, and we're talking outside of Moscow, you know, the richest city in the world,
yep,
by most standards.
Well,
these people are living on a $300 salary, and there's food in the stores, and no one can buy it.
Armin, you paint a really compelling picture, and I appreciate your sharing those insights. Forgive me, I want to get at least another call here and get back to Stephen, but I appreciate your call. One more, Yuri in Hartford, Connecticut. Yuri, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that in my point of view, Vladimir Putin will be president of Russia next year anyway.
He will be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he controls everything. He can control all election process, all this committee, or, you know, he has all public TV, everything.
And the protests, do they matter?
Actually, it's a protest. It's a matter only in Moscow, but nothing happened in regions.
Yuri, and I appreciate your call as well. I want to go to Stephen Cohen. Stephen, first, what do you make of how the U.S. has handled this? Hillary Clinton being critical of election rigging. And where do you see things going? If it is Putin again, and he's got some more Communist Party in the Duma, but you hear Julia saying they're effectively, they're not really rivals, they're co-opted. Where do you see things turning, Stephen?
Let me very quickly, since you invited me to do so, 100% disagree with Julia. To refer to the Communist Party as totally co-opted suggests that what we want the party to do is build some bombs and attack. To say that the Kremlin refers to the party as a loyal opposition is what all democracies call the opposition in parliament. They're supposed to be a loyal opposition. They're not supposed to be a revolutionary party anymore. They are certainly not co-opted. And if Putin wants to move in a populist direction, that is, respond to social and economic issues, he's going to need the party in the Duma. This is a separate election of a subject, so let's leave it aside.
Okay.
Let's come, because I think it's important, and you also suggested this, to the American reaction. I deeply regret what Mrs. Clinton said.
Why?
I don't think she should have said anything. I will tell you why. Two reasons. Let me report a conversation I had with a close friend of mine in Moscow, who's pretty liberal, pretty democratic. He was outraged when he heard her words, and he said, how do you think that goes down in Russia when every day we see police across the United States shutting down the occupiers much more violently than the police have done so far in Moscow.
Is that true? They had 50,000 police. That's a big number there.
Well, but the point is, how many occupiers have been cleared out in the last?
Arrested nearly 1,000 people in 2 days in Moscow.
And how many of them are in prison today, Julia?
Most of them.
No, Julia, 1,000 are in prison?
Absolutely.
But why shouldn't Hillary Clinton...
At the time, they released all but a handful.
This is about the nationalist question.
But the point here is the way Russians perceive what we're saying about them, while they're looking at the way we're handling our own protesters. That maybe not be my view, but if you're interested in what Russians think, you need to take it into account.
Julia, last word. What do you think? How do Russians respond to Hillary Clinton criticizing the vote? Very quickly, Julia.
I think the Russians right now who are interested in the protests are not really looking at what Hillary's saying. I think they're more concerned about Putin turning it into a Cold War rhetorical game to get the blame away from himself and the Kremlin. As for the nationalists, I've been to all of the protests. There are no nationalists there.
We've read about those sort of bust in, but that'll be a subject for another day. This just beginning to unfold. Julia Yaffe with The New Yorker and Foreign Policy, thank you. And Stephen Cohen at New York University, our deep thanks to you as well for joining us this hour. Listeners, thanks to you as well. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.